The excellent capitalist has imported bodily from Europe with his own good money, his own competitors. The end of the world has come. No wonder Wakefield laments.
CKUT's 2020 funding drive has been postponed indefinitely, but we are still accepting donations to help us sustain the station's operations while we remain closed due to COVID-19. Our wide network of volunteers provides an essential service to many different communities in Montreal, and the isolation of the past few months has highlighted how important independent news, arts and culture, and music programming is for Montreal's underrepresented communities. If you are in a position to give during this time, visit ckut.ca and click on the green Donate button to make a contribution, or contact funding@ckut.ca if you have any questions. Thank you for your continued support. Love, CKUT.
Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. I'm your host, Sarah DeAy, recording from home on February 18th, 2021. On tonight's show, my guests. Festival de la Bête Noire is here to haunt your dreams. Executive Director Mylène Chicoine.
I don't like winter. A lot of people don't like winter. There's not much going on between like January and June. You know, there's a, you know, Wildside Festival, there's Bougie Sea, there's other little festivals. I'm like, why not do something? Why not have horror in the middle of the year when no one expects it?
And we invite artists from La Bête Noire, Marissa Blair, and Jeroen Lindemann of Mad Paradox.
Came from a moment in my life, and it was late last year, where I was at a serious low, where I really considered doing things that people don't like to talk about. And instead of doing something about that, or instead of acting upon it, I decided to write this and to draw attention to it, and it kind of diffused my situation.
And Cheyenne Cranston of Home Theater Productions.
We don't want to end up in a situation where we're having to cancel more projects on artists. So we really sat and took a look at ourselves and kind of what can we do that can happen no matter what.
As well as Kamana Nibarikure of the Siegel Center, teaming up with Black Theatre Workshop.
We also spend a lot of time, you know, having questions that are unanswered, but we're adding questions to, you know, but by adding those questions, we're adding possibilities and we're finding ways out of problems, out of situations, you know, how we're going to reach out to this community, what should we do, so on and so forth.
But first, a few updates. Quebecers are gearing up to loosen more restrictions on daily life as spring break approaches. As of February 26th, two Fridays from now, rinks, pools, and movie theaters will reopen. The goal is to provide some entertainment outside the home for families. Museums already reopened last week, but of course, live theater is not included, which has some artists asking questions about when they can reopen. The Festival des Casteliers, the puppetry fest based in Outremont, has canceled a few live intimate events based on this latest update. On to tonight's conversations. A relative newcomer to the theater scene, Festival de la Bête Noire specializes in the macabre. Its annual arrival time to wash away the tepid, saccharine sweetness left over from Valentine's Day. Executive and artistic director Mylène Chicoine was determined to keep her festival going strong for its third edition, despite the restrictions of the pandemic. She's been working hard to bring a varied and eccentric lineup of shows available to stream or interact with for $5 each, including audio dramas, burlesque, ghost stories, and games. Festival de la Bête Noire launched its five-day run yesterday, though you can still partake until mid-March. Coming up, three artists from two different Bête Noire productions. But first, Mylène and her right-hand woman, Tyla Webster, spoke to me earlier this week. Good evening, Tyla and Mylène. Welcome to Upstage. How are you guys doing?
We're doing really, really great.
Fantastic. So how long does it take to put together Bête Noire? How long have you been working on this for, Mylène?
Like this year?
Yeah, for this edition.
I think that we finally settled on doing the online festival sometime in July or August. Late August is when we decided that, okay, we're going to do it this year. We're going to do this online. And so we started putting plans in motion in about since August.
Wow, it takes a long time to put something together, even when you don't have to like book a room mm-hmm. or figure out in-person logistics. Tyla, as Milan's kind of right-hand person, what kind of work goes into planning stuff, even if it's just online, like to do something in virtual?
It was actually a really big learning curve. We're all used to, shall we say, the bricks and mortar of all processes. So for us, it was a huge transition. Curation was different, how we were going to approach the shows and how they were going to be presented. So it's been a matter of learning what a digital or virtual platforms and presentations and limitations can and cannot do. It's about how to still connect with our performers and our audience so it is an authentic theatrical performance. And it's a matter of trying to be seen and heard in an even larger pool of you know, like the internet's a really huge place. So actually finding a way to navigate relationships and visibility through that has also been an even greater challenge, but it's been one that we've all sort of tackled head on with a lot of gusto.
I'm sure. It's so great to hear. Was there anything that surprised you about the process of going online as opposed to, love this expression, Tyla, the bricks and mortar, which we usually use for when we talk about retail store versus online shopping, right? But we can use it, I think, for creators too. Milan, was there anything that surprised you that you didn't expect in putting this together?
Yeah, actually, the global aspect was a really nice surprise for the festival this year. Like, we've always tried to have a bit of a global reach, but the platform, the online platform, really gave us the opportunity to reach far and wide in all corners of the world. And we've gotten such an overwhelming positive response from across the planet. And it's really great because next year, when we go back into a venue, maybe some of these artists can travel to Montreal and, you know, we can have a physical global presence instead of just an online one.
You're expanding your reach slowly but surely.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so let's get into the meat of the matter, Bête Noire. It's quite, I always find it like such an exciting thing to hear about in like the middle of winter when the days are short, nights are long and dark, and you know, Valentine's Day. I love Valentine's Day. It is a very saccharine holiday. Milan, can you tell me about you know, your vision for Festival de la Bête Noire when you were first started working on it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't want to do something around Halloween. I mean, first of all, there's a lot going on around Halloween in the first place. So that was the first thing. The second was, I don't like winter. A lot of people don't like winter. There's not much going on between like January and June. You know, there's a, you know, Wildside Festival, there's Bougie, there's other little festivals. I'm like, why not do something? Why not have horror in the middle of the year when no one expects it, you know? Mm-hmm. And then the third aspect was, Valentine's Day is not really my thing either. So why not play it up and create something that can appeal to the masses of anti-Valentine's Day vengeance and gore and heartbreak and loneliness, and tackle that aspect. So we settled on the weekend after Valentine's Day to kind of address all of these things. And one thing that I like to say a lot is, why should horror just be around Halloween when it can be all year round?
I also would like to tack on something else that Milan also has mentioned before, but didn't mention now. For those people who, during Valentine's Day and, you know, all that mushy fun stuff, that they are horror fans within Valentine's Day celebrators as well. So mm-hmm. an opportunity to have a late Valentine's Day gift where you can cuddle up and
right.
freak each other out.
Yeah.
So speaking of freaking each other out, you have a very well-rounded presentation this year. I almost dare to say it seems like your programming is bigger than in the past. And I'm not sure that's correct. And I'm also not sure if it's because, you know, being online, it was easier to reach out and to program more things. Maybe you could correct me on that or clarify.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. We decided this year to kind of take in as many as we could, just because we have the opportunity to do it online and we're not limited to a physical space with the finances that come with a physical space. And we started with a lot more than what is in the program. We lost about half because of pandemic issues and, you know, all those kinds of things. So we also anticipated that this would happen. So it's like, if we take as many as we can, knowing that we're going to lose probably half, we're still going to have a lot of shows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a very well-rounded series so far, because I'm hearing there's something that's audio related. I'm thinking theater productions as well. They're doing really interesting work. There's a whole bunch of different stuff. So when you were setting out to pick out the programming this year, and Tyla or Milan, you can take this question, what were you looking for exactly in order to make an online festival really sing?
Tyla, go ahead.
Well, sure. You can jump in. I think for us, because of COVID, because of the situation that we're all confronted with right now, we sort of expanded our own views as to what horror, I mean, it's already a very expansive genre, but I think we sort of widened our own perspectives and ideas of what this could mean and how it can be interpreted. And so we have horror comedies, we have audio plays that you've already mentioned. There were a lot of things that also were more like a horrific scenario. So we had to sort of have to filter through what was still true to the horror concept in its essence versus social, a lot of social difficulties that we're all confronted with. So we tried to sort of balance that, which was really, really key, and yet still touch on it. So when curating, we had that in the back of our minds.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Milan, do you have any couple words about the curation process?
Yeah, I mean, it was really, me personally, looking through the applications, it was, okay, we have, it was great to see that there was so much variety coming in. So it allowed for this very well-rounded programming that we have. It's like, I want puppets. Hey, we have them. I want audio plays. Hey, we have those too. I want solos. Oh, we have one of those too. And it's super great that was part of the reason why we took so many in, because it's like, we can have as much variety as we want within the horror genre in a multidisciplinary fashion that you wouldn't otherwise be able to have in a physical space.
Now, I know I'm speaking with Milan Chicoine, who is the artistic and executive director at Le Festival de la Bête Noire, and also joining us is Tyla Webster, Milan's right-hand person, the backstage shadow, as Milan described her shortly before we started speaking. Now, I know it's always hard to pick a favorite or something that stands out, because you have like a dozen shows, a dozen components here. But maybe both of you could pick one or two things that stood out to you or struck you as a bit different or something that you're really excited for.
Okay. I haven't seen them all yet. I'm still in the process of watching all the shows. So I'm going to give a shout out right now to the Peony Lantern. They are from Japan. And part of the reason I love their show. It was really great. But we had a bit of a strict post-production, a no post-production formula for our festival this year to keep the authenticity of the live aspect as close to possible. And they really, really took that to heart with their projections and their stage. And they kept everything within the space where they were creating their show. And it was just, it's amazing to watch. Of course, watching it live would be a whole other thing, but they really, really took their technical restrictions and created something beautiful. I'm going to give them that shout out. And I'm personally really excited. I haven't watched it yet, but I'm very, very looking forward to watching Pento, because I think it touches on issues that are often ignored, and that the festival is all about confronting the dark issues that live within us. And this show is a show that will accomplish that. It really puts it out there, like, men's mental health is important. Let's do something about it.
And really topical too, as well, mm-hmm. as we're all kind of combating our own demons with the extended, you know, curfew / lockdown / the scariness of being in a pandemic. So Pento and the Peony Lantern. I love that both of those titles, by the way. Tyla, is there anything that you're looking forward to?
I haven't had an opportunity to watch everything. I did actually manage to listen to both of our audio plays, which surprisingly I had this transcendent moment to what it must have been like in, you know, like the 1930s, 40s and 50s, sitting at home in front of a wireless. So that was sort of like a really pleasant moment, which I didn't anticipate experiencing. So that for me was really, really fun. I have to agree with Milena in regards to the Peony Lantern. It was really phenomenal what I saw. And I'll say also another shout out to there's a show called The Witch Among Us, and it is from the
Latino Theater Initiative.
That's it. I always convert them. Thank you. They are coming out of Texas, and it is a well-established group out of the University of Rio Grande University. And they did a really great job. They had to switch up how they were going to address the performance, how they're going to do it. I found that they were very communicative and expressive in what they were doing, and it turned out wonderfully well. So a shout out to them as well. And a big one for Poe in the Snow. I haven't watched it yet, but I'm really looking forward to that one, because that one has a bunch of people from across the world in it as well. So I'm looking forward mm-hmm. to that.
And I'll add that hearing some of your coup de cœur so far, Milene, you spoke earlier on about the international flavor that you're able to bring people, thanks to the internet, from all over the place. And the Peony Lantern, a Japanese company, The Witch Among Us from South Texas, mm-hmm. not something that would mm-hmm. necessarily be feasible for an up-and-coming theater festival, right? To bring someone in from an ocean away, right?
Or exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this kind of, I'm sure, is fueling a lot of big ideas and ambition for the festival in 2022, I'm guessing.
Let's hope so.
Well, I remember there was a conversation way back when that, you know, if we could have, like, what would be your greatest wish? What could we do with the festival? And of course, it was always a matter of how far and wide we could expand it to Canada or elsewhere. And so in a very strange way, COVID has granted us a really big wish in a very strange way.
Mm-hmm. No, that's very true.
That's so beautiful. Guys, I'm really looking forward to the festival. We'll see you online. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to make time to speak with us.
And thank you, Sarah.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
That was Milene Chicoine, Artistic Director and Executive Director with Assistant Tyla Webster of Festival de la Bête Noire. The festival runs until Sunday, but the content is available online until March 15th. Find the shows and more information at labetenoirefest.com. Each ticket only $5. I'm Sarah De A. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at ckut.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week, February 18th, 2021. Now, two interviews with artists on the slate for Bête Noire. A bit later on, I will learn more about how a personal crisis inspired Mad Paradox's work. But first, Home Theater Productions has put together Only Footprints, a show that melds theater with an interactive game. A bloodthirsty killer is trailing after you, the hero, and only you know what to do next. Executive Director Cheyenne Cranston says her writer and performer, both roommates, hatched and filmed several plot points to ensure that nearly every play is different for the audience. Cheyenne joined me earlier this week. Welcome to Upstage, Cheyenne. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great, thank you.
Thank you for joining Upstage. So Home Theater Productions, your show is called Only Footprints. You and I were just chatting about, you know, putting together the first few productions of being a new theater company. It takes a lot to get things off the ground, and then a pandemic hits. Can you tell me a bit about what Home Theater Production, like how you guys have been coping through 2020 and into 2021, what that's meant for the work that you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. This was something that we grappled with right at the beginning of the pandemic last March, because we had a production that was slated to go up at the end of March and had to cancel it right as we were about to go into tech for the production. So it was fully rehearsed, ready to go, and we had to make the decision to cancel it. And so that was kind of how the pandemic started for us. And then it's been a lot of kind of figuring out, okay, well, what are we going to do with this time? We don't want to end up in a situation where we're having to cancel more projects on artists. So we really sat and took a look at ourselves and kind of what can we do that can happen no matter what. So we did a project for This Is Not a Fringe in the summer, which was an adaptation of the project we were originally going to put up for the Fringe Festival Live. And we've also been working on a new play development series. We did a call out for playwrights, like emerging artists across the country, because everything's digital now. And we have three amazing new playwrights that Lucas Amato and Steve Greenwood, who's our artistic director, have been working with throughout the past few months to develop their plays that will eventually be presented in a live public reading. And then we've been working on this awesome project for Festival de la Bête Noire. So we've been, you know, trying to keep busy despite everything.
It's the only thing you can do, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, your project during Sistine Prison Fringe, This Is Not a Fringe, it stood out to me, number one, because it was a choose-your-own-adventure. It just oozed fun when I, at the time, I was speaking with Amy Blackmore and organizers of the festival. And it also felt like something that really pivoted well to being online. It wasn't just something that had been filmed and edited into like a short film or a live performance. It felt like something that was designed for the web and would present a really fun, unique experience. And I think it's because it has this game quality to it, right? That you're choosing your own path. How did you guys seize upon that as a format? Was it something that you'd always wanted to do, or something that just kind of came to you as the best way to kind of tell the story?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because our show that we were going to do live for Fringe before Fringe was canceled due to the pandemic was an interactive kind of experience that we were going to curate. So we had a space in off Fringe, and it was going to be, you would interact with actors. And so basically like a live version of the online version we ended up presenting. So that it was kind of a natural transition for This Is Not a Fringe, where our artistic director, Steve Greenwood, and he also wrote the show as well, kind of looked at it and went, okay, how can we adapt what we were already going to do live onto an online format? Because we really wanted to do something interactive. And it's an important part of our aesthetic as a company that we're very into pop culture and video games and just geeky stuff. So it seemed like a very natural kind of transition into the online world of, well, then why don't we make it a video game? And then with Only Footprints, we were like, okay, you know, the last project was kind of a transition that had to happen because of the pandemic. So let's create something completely new that is designed to be online.
Right. Let's continue to play with this format and make it even better.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's walk me through the story, because we can't forget, you know, at the heart of every video game, there is the action and the fun of it, but there's also a story. And that can't be neglected, right? I understand there's a bloodthirsty killer after the protagonist, you. Tell me about how you went about building what the story would be.
Yeah, so Steve wrote the show, and he was very inspired by, you know, slasher video games. And slasher video games, slasher movies. You know, when you're watching a horror movie, I feel like you see this on online all the time. People are like, if I was in a horror movie, I never would have done that, right? And things like that. So that was kind of a lot of the inspiration. So the game itself is, the idea is that you're being chased by a horror movie villain and you have to make decisions and also solve riddles. So, and, you know, find clues to get to hopefully escape the villain. And then we tied in theater by having Lucas Amato, who's an amazing actor, record 14 different endings as as the killer. So there's 14 different endings with Lucas as the killer. Most of them are point of view where you get killed by the killer. So it's very exciting.
I suppose you anticipate that people will be trying to do all the different versions to get each possible equation or ending.
Yeah, absolutely. The best thing about it is that if you get stuck, you can just die and start again and try to find a different ending.
Cheyenne Cranston is the executive director of Home Theater Productions, and we are speaking about Only Footprints, which is part of the Festival de la Bête Noire, the 2021 edition, which has gone virtual. So, I mean, you have to kind of balance having a good, like, because of, this is meant to be theater, but also a video game, I'm wondering about the challenge of making the story, you know, be of high caliber, Lucas's performances being something that will fit into the theater realm, but also making sure that these riddles and these games are challenging. Do you feel like you ever spent too much time on crafting the games and then had to kind of be like, we got to make sure that the story holds it up as well? Wondering how you kind of walked your way through that.
Yeah, it was definitely an interesting kind of balancing act. One thing Steve did with the game that I think is super awesome is there's kind of the starting point, there's four kind of main paths you can take that then spiral out from there. And each path has different levels of difficulty. So there's one that is a lot harder than the others, so that people who are looking for different gameplay experiences can really kind of explore and see, oh, well, this one's way too hard, I'm going to try a different one. It's very tricky, that line between what is theater and what is video game and what is kind of being digital. But we just really wanted to create that connection with the audience, because that's something we at Home Theater really, really value and really strive for, is connecting with the audience. We love doing shows at Mainline Theater and kind of a small space where you can get up close and personal. So we were really throughout the project going, okay, how do we create that experience, even if it's mediated through a computer?
Also wondering about Steve crafting the story and how to keep all those different plot lines. You said there's 14 different endings, right? How do you keep that? Is he using cue cards, or does he have like a big kind of like detective wall where he's got like yarn linking one plot line to another?
You know, it's funny because obviously Steve and I haven't been able to be in the same physical space because of the pandemic. But, you know, for me, that's how I imagine it, is some big, you know, kind of wall of with all the red yarn going around it, trying to figure out what the different paths do. He used a program called Twine, which is what the game's built on, which is designed to do things like that.
Very apropos, because that harkens back to the yarn or the string we're using to tie things together.
Yeah, exactly.
And as, partnering with Steve, did you ever, you know, have a moment where he was walking you through a scenario and you said, you know, you had to say like, hey, that sounds too similar to scenario, you know, 8, or does that contradict another thing? Like, I just imagine this is so complicated. It's like a Matryoshka doll, story within a story. Like,
yeah, absolutely. For me, I did a lot more of the kind of producer work and kind of stuff like that. So there wasn't really too much with that for me, but I'm sure him and Lucas had a lot of conversations about how that was going to play out kind of as the actor and the director / writer working on this. And also it's very interesting because Bête Noire had a rule where you weren't allowed to do any post-production editing as the videos. So that was something that was a challenge for us, because we kind of had some ideas that we were going to, you know, do something and we're like, okay, we can't do post-production. So if we want to have, you know, music with the slasher villain, we have to, you know, have that live with Lucas acting. So that was also like a really kind of interesting challenge of like, how do you present something that looks good and polished, but also has that kind of unedited feel to it.
It must be such a frustrating rule, but at the same time, making you think out of the box.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in order to play, does one need anything complicated or can you just, you know, be on your browser?
So you just need a browser. So when you buy your ticket, you'll get a HTML file and you click it, you download it and it'll open in a browser. Google Chrome is best. Mm-hmm. If you are someone who is not really into playing, but you want the kind of experience of seeing what happens, we have this super exciting event on Saturday at 8 p.m. right after Bette Noir's Friday the 13th hour, where we're doing a live playthrough of the game with Montreal's own Uma God and Selma God, mm-hmm. Playing it on their Twitch channel. So they're going to do a live playthrough of the game, which is totally free. You can just show up and watch on Twitch. And it's going to be super amazing. I love Uma God and Selma God. I've been fans of theirs forever. And so, yeah, they're going to do a live playthrough of the game if you want to kind of experience it and see it before you get your ticket and try to play yourself.
Yes, because the show will be available. The festival itself is 5 days, but you can still zoom in until March 15th. And that's so cool that you got the Uma God to take part. I think that's so wild. Cheyenne, I'm super excited to play the game and to see which scenarios I get, which endings I end up in. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah.
That was Cheyenne Cranston, Executive Director of Home Theater Productions. They are presenting Only Footprints, a choose-your-own-adventure experience as part of Festival de la Bête Noire. To play, visit labetenoirefest.com. And as Cheyenne mentioned, drag queen Uma God will stream as she plays through the game on Saturday night. Still to come on Upstage, the Siegel Center and Black Theater Workshop team up to present a visual tribute to Black History Month. I'm Sarah Day, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week, February 18th, 2021. One more look at one of the many shows presented by La Bête Noire, the Horror Theater Festival, back for its third edition this week. A warning, in this interview, suicide will be mentioned and discussed. You can take a break for the next 10 to 12 minutes, or fast forward if you are listening in the archives. The pandemic is testing the limits of mental health as we deal with upheaval, uncertainty, and isolation. Writer Jeroen Lindemann chose to explore a low point he was going through in order to create Panto, presented by Mad Paradox. Jeroen and his director, Marissa Blair, spoke to me about the show and an important and sometimes overlooked angle of mental health. Welcome to Upstage, Marissa and Jeroen. How are you both doing this week?
We're great, thanks.
We're fine, thank you. Thank you for having us.
Of course. Thank you for being here. So Panto, the title of your show, curious, it's all in capitals. Does it stand for anything? Is it an acronym? Can you let me in on that? Or is that something to be unveiled during the show?
Oh, that's a tricky question. Do we want to divulge on that, Marissa?
I think that what we can say is that Panto is the name of, I guess, the release. I guess it's a mystery. We want to keep it a mystery.
No problem.
No
problem at all. Milen highlighted your piece when I was chatting with her earlier, because it touches on mental health, which is something that's topical, especially nowadays in this wild times we're living in. Was that a conscious decision that you made to touch on something that's so current that everyone's kind of grappling with day to day? Jeroen, I don't know if you want to take that question first.
Yeah, sure. It came from a moment in my life, and it was late last year where I was at a serious low where I really considered doing things that people don't like to talk about. And instead of doing something about that, or instead of acting upon it, I decided to write this and to draw attention to it, and it kind of diffused my situation.
Awesome. Was it, at what point did you think to yourself, I'm ready to actually share this with everyone else? Was that an immediate feeling, or did it come to you a bit later?
It was in the same weekend that I wrote it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a pretty direct turnaround. Marissa, how did you, at what point did you get, did you enter the conversation in terms of bringing this to a stage, or rather a computer near you?
Yeruna contacted me very shortly after he wrote it and said, I think I've got something and I think it's important and I think we need to work on it and share it. So yeah, we decided, I think very early on, that this was something we needed to do, that this project is to serve as an entry point of discussion of a stigmatized issue, that there's a, it is a play, but it has a bigger message.
So mental health is a big word. It can mean so many different things to so many different people in terms of individual experiences. Can you give me a glimpse into what kind of issues or experiences that you're tackling?
The play itself does not go into a very specific part of mental health. Suicide is a large portion of it, but there are so many reasons why people want to commit suicide. For me personally, I got recently diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. Mm-hmm. And yeah, a lot that comes from, that is in Pento, comes directly from my personal situation in that.
This might be kind of a silly question, but is it hard to write about stuff that's so personal? And, you know, and realizing you're making it available to a wider audience?
Yeah, I have to convince myself continuously that this is a good thing, because displaying such a heavy piece is putting a lot on people. But the intention that I have is to bring attention to the problems that we have and that we don't talk about in society. It's a taboo. It's not being... People don't talk about it, and I just want to start that conversation. And I think men's mental health is a big problem that's really underestimated and hidden and affecting a lot of people day to day.
And so much worse so in the last year, right? Just because our lives have been upended, even if, you know, things are still kind of status quo, we're still dealing with a kind of fear of what the pandemic presents, and also just how, you know, your day-to-day has changed. Has it made you, what's happened over the last year, changed how you approach your writing or how you talk about these difficult issues?
Well, things got more to the surface, and the more society got into problems, I got more into the problem, and yeah, there was no longer hiding it.
Right.
And I just had to do something with it. And just picking up the pen was the only thing that I could think of to do.
Right. Well, thank you for taking that big step forward. It's a scary thing to embark on, but I think the world is kind of the richer for it, for hearing people's experiences like your own. Marissa, as the director of this piece, what was kind of going through your mind as you navigate telling this personal story and bringing it to a wider audience?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because I feel very personally connected to this story, because Yeruna is my friend and also my production company executive director.
Yeah.
Like we have a lot of conversations when it comes to our production company about what kind of work we want to present. And we've always known that we want to push boundaries and break from conformity. And we want to take we want to make performances that take risks. And a lot of what we do is we create original works that draw upon documentary theater methods to transpose stories to stage. And so this is something that we're used to doing. We're used to working with our own lives that inform our work. But with this, with Pento specifically, it hit a real, personal point with me because it was my friend dealing with suicide.
Yeah.
And that was something that was really difficult for me to deal with, I think. But in the telling of the story, in the development of it, I think that I've never really done it before, but something that I really was important to me is that we were both in therapy. Like, I needed a therapist and Yoru needed a therapist, and that was going to be with us through the process. And also, because I'm not a professional therapist,
right.
And so I can't really guide Yoru through what he needs to do on his own. So as long as you had your therapist, saying that this was okay for you to do and you were continuing in therapy, then I think that we can do this together. But it made me realize, like, the current climate for men's mental health has come to this critical point in history where these strategies need to be made to address this increasing number of men who are experiencing these mental health related challenges. And theater, as a site for social change, it can play this major role in bringing the issues of men's mental health to light. And so this play is like initializing this step in creating the conversation to provide support to men who are affected by trauma. So it's for Yoru specifically and personally for him. It's for me to understand what he goes through and then to relate it to how this can relate to other men and mental health and other women as well who know men who are struggling with mental health issues. I think it's for everyone. So yes, it's very personal, but it also, I felt the importance of it, that it needed to be shared.
Speaking with Marissa Blair and Yoru Lindemann of Pento by Mad Paradox, you zero in on men and mental health issues. I hear, it's a challenge because it's hard to open up or it's hard to be honest with feelings. There's this stigma. There's also this sense that, you be a man and take it and be quiet. Is that some of the issues you were facing when you talk not just about mental health, but mental health and what it's like for men? Marissa or Yoru, not sure who would want to take that.
I sure had my own struggles in finding a way of getting the help I needed and to express my my struggles and my my need to get help and to become better. And a lot of men face that issue too. If you just look at the suicide statistics, the reason why men are so much more often kill themselves because they are so desperate and they take the absolute measures in making sure that they don't come back.
Mm-hmm.
But that also affects their families. And you see it in so many things, as in alcohol abuse and domestic violence and all those things. And if we can just get men to come out of their shell of their problems and to express more and better and be felt supported, and if they can just feel that they have a voice and they can express it and there's no shame in that, then we can solve so many more problems.
So having said that, what do you hope the audience takes away after seeing Pento, the conversation that's going to unfold after seeing your piece? Marissa?
Well, by sharing this play, we act as advocates for reducing stigmas around men's mental health. We want to give a voice to those who have been conditioned not to speak up about their struggles, and we want to aid in the fight for personal and social wellness.
Well said. I think it'll do that, absolutely. And I'm really looking forward to seeing the piece as well. And thank you both for being so open about what this process is like. It's hard to write about difficult things in your life, but also difficult to talk about the process itself. And especially in a collaboration like yours, I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
That was writer Yeruen Lindemann and director Marissa Blair. Their work, Mad Paradox, is available to stream until March 15th as part of Festival de la Bête Noire. Visit the Horror Theater Festival at labetenoirefest.com for tickets and more information. I'm Sarah DeAy, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at ckut.ca. The Siegel Center, a cornerstone of the arts in Montreal's Jewish community, is partnering with Black Theatre Workshop to celebrate Black History Month, and they are doing it with a free public art show that airs nightly from 5:30 to just before curfew. Liberation's Radiance is conceived by Tim Rodriguez, a lighting designer and artist in residence at BTW. You can see images and a video at the Siegel's website and Instagram page to find out more. Inspired by biblical passages as well as Ta-Nehisi Coates' novel, The Water Dancer, Tim uses shimmering shades of green and blue to depict the path to liberation as traveled by the ancestors and people today. But it's not just a light show. The series includes spotlights on Black artists in conversation with Kamana Nibarakure, a theater artist herself, who was also the first to take on a new role at the Siegel as BIPOC artist advocate and artistic advisor. Kamana joined me yesterday to talk about her work and Liberation's Radiance. Welcome back to Upstage, Kamana. How are you doing?
I am doing great. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, so great to have you joining me. And this, we have so much to talk about because there's a fantastic project, fantastic conversations, as well as your role with the Siegel Center. Why don't we, that we'll touch on, why don't we start with the presentation itself. Tim Rodriguez, a very talented lighting designer based in Montreal, nominated for Metas, winning Metas. He does really cool work. It's called Liberation's Radiance. Can you tell me a bit about the development process?
Once I was appointed as the working at the Siegel as their BIPOC advocate, Liberation's Radiance is my first kind of project. So Lisa came up with the idea to have a lighting installation and in collaboration with Black Theatre Workshop for Black History Month. And so they commissioned Tim, and, you know, Tim being the amazing artist that he is, he came up with the whole statement. He had this whole thing that he is transmitting through the piece. And we just started talking it through, you know, he just wanted somebody to kind of bounce his ideas on. And then I was like, well, you know, what would be great? It would be to bring forth more voices to the installation. And that's kind of how I came to be. I just kind of joined Tim's endeavor, and it became what it is now.
It feels so organic. And do you feel like that kind of defines how, you know, the artistic process is happening at the Siegel?
Yes. I really, really like this position because it's in development, but I'm working closely with Lisa Rubin, who's the artistic and executive director, of course, and John, who's the general manager, and just the team. Like, I'm on the team meetings, and it's just all these conversations that I can be a part of where I'm learning, but I'm also bringing my perspective. So it's really shaping up to be what I expected and more.
That's awesome to hear. Could you maybe just describe us what people might see passing by the Siegel on Côte Saint-Catherine between those 2 hours?
Yes. So basically it's a light installation. So it's telling a story through light, It's, of course, it's programmed, so you can see different flashes, how it progresses, how it goes from the green to the blue. It's a very evocative piece.
Yes.
And I think that you can see, like, I love it because you can see it without having read the artistic statement, and mm-hmm. you'll be like, oh wow. Mm-hmm. And then you read the statement and you're like, oh wow. And if you start with the statement and watch the piece after, it gives you a different experience, you know? So there's so much to it.
I'm speaking with Kamana Nibarikure, who is working with the Siegel Center as the BIPOC artist advocate and artistic advisor. We're talking about Liberation's Radiance, which you can check out now, 5:30 to 7:30 in front of the Siegel Center as a special event, something that, you know, you can see as you pass through the center, as we're not really allowed, still able to gather. There's an online component. You've hinted at these conversations and the further discussion that accompanies this visual presentation. So it's not just about the Siegel Center and Tim's work. We're also bringing in Black Theater Workshop here and their artist mentorship program, which is just a fantastic platform, I think, for young emerging artists. Tell me about the conversations. Who have you been speaking with so far this month?
As far as the reflections, as far yes. as the mentorship program. Okay, so we have three artists lined up. So the way that we saw it was like, okay, so it's a month long event. So mm-hmm. the first week is really focused on the lighting installation itself. So, you know, first week was that. And as of the second week, we bring on these artists. So the first artist was Marilyn Chéry. She is an incredible poet, actor, dramaturg. She did two women's shows. She's bilingual, French, English, actually trilingual, because she also speaks Creole. She's wow. from Haitian descent and is very present in her art. And we just had this great conversation that stemmed from the piece itself. And, you know, we talked about her art, her life as an artist. And then we just dived into kind of, you know, like what we talked about, like coming to America, you know, like how the movie is coming up and things like that. So it's very fun and cheeky. Sorry?
It's accessible.
Yes, it's super yeah. accessible. And then we have folks on the Zoom. The first part is just like really like me interviewing the artist, and then after that we have an open Q&A. And yeah, so it's very easy and just fun.
Oh, fantastic. So there'll be one more that we can catch Wednesday, February the 24th, I believe. Who will you be speaking with then?
We'll be talking with a great playwright. Her name is Willow Chiopa. And so we'll be talking with her.
You were appointed in 2020, so in the last calendar year, as in your role as BIPOC artist advocate and artistic advisor with the Siegel Center, Kamana. How do you see your role? I understand it's something that's in development. You're working on, you know, what exactly your I guess goals are, or how you're going to be involved in ongoing productions and work. Where do you see your role evolving as?
I see this role as a bridge, you know. So it's a bridge between how we've been doing things and how we want to do things. So I don't, you know, I don't take myself as like, you know, knowing every single thing and knowing how, you know, being the book for best practices. But I have a lot of experience on and off the stage, and just being part of the conversations opens up another perspective,
right.
and brings us to, you know, solutions that are more inclusive. And just more more thought through also. We also spend a lot of time, you know, having questions that are unanswered, but we're adding questions to, you know, but by adding those questions, we're adding possibilities and we're finding ways out of problems, out of situations, you know, how are we gonna reach out to this community, what should we do, so on and so forth. So I feel like since I'm not, you know, I'm from the theater world, but right now I'm not attached to theater particularly. My experience as like a freelance performer and a freelance director is, you know, is really helpful.
Statement from Lisa Rubin, who is the top boss there at the Siegel Center. And she mentioned that it's a time for racial justice. There's a rise in anti-Semitism, but she talks about bringing Black and Jewish communities together and to cooperate, to collaborate, to talk about challenges facing these communities and other communities as well. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I feel like, yeah, like it's about time. That's how I feel. No, for real, it's about time, because I'm thinking, like, for instance, you know, the Siegel Center and Black Theater Workshop, two staples of Canadian theater, two staples of theater, especially in Montreal. And, you know, to me, they haven't created the opportunities to come together as often as you think they would, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like representing communities that have been marginalized, you know? So I'm like, well, and also I'm like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm talking to Lisa and I'm like, well, what about Black Jews? You know, there are Black Jews. Where are their stories? Where are they, you know? Or, you know, not necessarily just Black Jews, but like, you know, Jewish people from all sorts of community, like Jewish people come from all over the world, you know? And that's what I like about Lisa. She's very open. We have these great conversations, and like, you know, they brought Nakuset. Nakuset is an indigenous woman that was, as a child, was part of the 60s coup in Canada, where indigenous children were basically taken away from their families to be adopted into other families. And in her case, Nakuset was adopted by a Jewish family, hence why the Siegel Center was giving that platform. But I think, you know, to me, it might be simplistic to say that, but I don't see it as Jewish history, Indigenous history, Black history. I really see it as, this is our Canadian history. This is all our history. So, yeah, I love that those initiatives are taken at the Siegel, and I'm happy to be there experiencing that and pushing that forward.
I think that's so well put. And I now have a vision of you as the kind of the a little bird, like on Lisa's shoulders almost. Yeah. Pointing things out. And that's so interesting to have an institution like that with such a long legacy, being able to open up a space for someone to kind of to nudge and to point and to kind of make those suggestions. It's an interesting job to have for sure. And I hope we can keep talking to you about it as things evolve. So congratulations on your new appointment, and as well as the conversations ongoing through this month. One more left to check out before Black History Month comes to an end. Thank you so much for your time, Kamana.
Thank you so much. I was very happy to be here.
That was Kamana Nibarakure, BIPOC advocate and artist advisor at the Siegel Center. You can see Liberation's Radiance in front of the Siegel Center at 5170 Côte Saint-Catherine in Côte-des-Neiges from 5:30 to 7:30 until February 28th. Kamana's final conversation is this coming Wednesday. Register and learn more at siegelcenter.org. You have been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at ckut.ca. Tonight you heard Mylène Chicoine and Tyler Webster of Festival de la Bête Noire. The fest includes Marissa Blair and Yeruin Lindemann of Pento and Cheyenne Cranston of Only Footprints. as well as Kamana Nibarakure of the Siegel Center. A big thank you to all of my guests. You can hear past episodes of Upstage at ckut.ca under Archives. Thank you to Tamara at CKUT for making sure this show gets to air. And thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Sarah DeAy. Speak with you next time on Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at ckut.ca. And with that, until next time, stay home and stay safe. Listen to your radio. It's calling for you. Radio. There's nothing else you can do. And everything I had to know, I heard it on CKUT Radio 90.3.
School. The records of your claim are secure. They will be destroyed in September 2027 unless you choose to keep them or share them. To learn more, call toll-free 1-877-635-2648 or go to myrecordsmychoice.ca.
Good evening and welcome to the February 18th edition of Grey Matters. Tonight on the show we have a lecture entitled Chaos or Community. It was recorded in Nashville, Tennessee on January 22nd of this year. The lecture is by Michael Eric Dyson. He's a globally renowned scholar of race and religion and contemporary culture and is the Centennial Chair and University Distinguished Professor of African American and Diaspora Studies at Vanderbilt University. He's a dynamic speaker. He lectures widely, and among his many books are April 4, 1968, Martin Luther King's Death and How It Changed America, Tears We Cannot Stop, Holler If You Hear Me, Searching for Tupac Shakur, and Jay-Z, Made in America. So, without further ado, here's tonight's lecture, Chaos or Community, by Michael Eric Dyson.
Black Lives Matter, community. White supremacists on the mall, chaos. Where do we go from here? Chaos. Challenge.